Hey everyone, I want to welcome you to today's episode of the HX Podcast. I feel very blessed and lucky to have one of my great friends, a former colleague, an absolute technology investing star, my old friend Rom from Octahedron Capital join us today. And just to start, I'm going to tell everyone, I call him Rom P for his first initial because his last name is a little difficult for me to pronounce. But how are you doing today, Rom?
Doing really well, Rick. Thank you for having me back on the podcast. And I remember the last time you chastised me for calling you Rick. So I'm going to call you Enrique going forward.
Whichever one works. So just because everyone can see, you know, we have your full last name out there on the title of the podcast. How do you pronounce your last name? Give it to me one more time.
Well, I've been called Parmesan for the most part.
Okay.
You know, the real name is Parameshwaran.
Okay, there we go. So we've got it out there officially. So what I'd love to do, Rom, you know, you and I have spoken a bit. We're going to cover a couple topics here. But first, you know, look, I have a very unique background for this business coming from Arizona and like just no one in my family ever owning a stock. The only bond they ever did was to get out of jail. You know, you have a different but similarly diverse background. Just tell us a little bit, like, you know, and just so the audience knows, Rom and I worked together at a very successful hedge fund called Falcon Edge Capital just about 10 years ago. But give us a quick, like, 3 to 5 minute on your background and where you find yourself today, because I think the audience will find it fascinating.
Yeah, well, thank you, Enrique, for having me. Quick background is I grew up in India. I grew up in Africa and Southeast Asia. My dad was an engineer. We kept traveling around. Like many people, I turned 21, got my undergrad degree in engineering in India because that's one way to get out of what I call the middle class poverty trap in some ways. And, you know, I found myself fascinated by America and the opportunity here simply because, you know, I think people underestimate the influence that American brands and American culture has all over the world, and it's a very aspirational country to be at, but nothing special. I came to America to get my master's in electrical engineering. I went to a state school in the southwest of Virginia called Virginia Tech, and I studied wireless communications.
Are those the Hokies, by the way?
They are the Hokies, the Turkeys.
Okay, exactly, there we go.
Hokies. I still love them. And
impress myself.
Exactly. Great school. Great welcome to this country. And then I ended up working at Qualcomm out in San Diego.
Yep.
This is in 2003, got my first full-time job. And Enrique, you remember the 3G boom day starting 2003.
Yep.
And I was one of the engineers/senior engineers behind the scenes.
We talked about this last time, but right. When I started at Lehman Brothers, we took them public.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, Qualcomm was this thing that everyone was like, that will never work. You know, it was binary. Qualcomm was a biotech stock.
It really
that,
was.
You know, they were like, it works in the lab, and if it works in the real world, it's going to be worth, you know, $50 billion when that used to be a lot of money for a company.
Yes.
But 2003, man, that's like that's like working, you know, like hitting the perfect wave for 3G and Qualcomm.
Yeah, I think you were talking about the first wave where CDMA was unproven as a technology, and then,
yep,
you know, that became one of the big norms in the U.S. And then, of course, it benefited from the big wireless telco boom of 1999-2000. I joined, yep, after the crash and burn had happened, and then I was within the rubble. But luckily, that's a great time to just join a company. And that was just when the next wave was taken off, which is 3G. And so I was part of the team that commercialized the first many generations of 3G chips all over the world. Okay. So I used to live all over the world and commercialize these chips. Anyway, long story short, by the time I turned my late 20s, I was kind of tired just being a senior manager in Qualcomm. Ended up going to business school at the University of Chicago. Really wanted to become a product manager in tech for the most part, but then got fascinated with technology companies. Well, got fascinated with technology companies on the one hand because the wireless internet boom had just started because guess what? We had gone from 3G to the first version of 4G in quote unquote.
Yep.
And we had the first killer wireless device with the introduction of the iPod or with a wireless chip in it, which is called the iPhone.
Right.
You remember the big unveiling in 2006.
Yeah.
Simultaneously, again, Chicago is a great finance school. So I just said, you know, if I'm here, I'm paying all this money, let me study some finance. And that began this lifelong fascination and falling in love with finance.
Okay.
Anyway, so I graduated in 2011. I could not get a job at the buy side because I really did not have the experience. I did not know what a three-statement model was. I did not know a bunch of stuff.
It's hard to break from the, if you're not in the sell side or you don't kind of previously have it in, it's hard to break into the buy side.
It really is. But I knew that I had no edge in figuring out, I don't know, chemicals and consumer and industrials. But I did have some real edge in investing in technology. And I still believe to this day that, you know, if you have to really be immersed in what happens in technology, you've got to be vested in the Rockies and ideally in the California Bay Area region. But anyway, so I ended up on the sell side at Sanford Bernstein. Did that for a couple of years, after which our former colleague and boss, Rick Gerson and Navroz Advaria, hired me to be a consultant to cover internet stocks, which is when I found you and I sat next to you for 2.5 years. You know, was a trained short seller on the short side, but it was kind of easy to buy stocks on the long side because you bought Facebook and Amazon and kind of went to sleep for the most part. But that's how I met our other colleague, George Yang, who took me to China to diligence with him Alibaba's pre-IPO run and Didi Taxi, which is when I started getting really exposed to the scale of the internet, not only in the US, but outside the US as well, specifically in China. That's how I convinced Rick and Navroz to build the India Private Fund, which became a very successful product for them. And I played a very small role in getting that product off the ground. Spent 2 years with that team and then came to California for my wife's job in 2014. Now, she was at the Boston Consulting Group, you know, doing private equity diligences. And then Andreessen Horowitz wanted to hire somebody to really build out the research process in their second venture capital fund. And so she got lucky to become a VC. And her old boss, Jeff Jordan and Mark Andreessen, hired her to really kind of build out world-class research within a venture firm.
That is as like in the network as you could possibly be working for. We actually, this week, I wrote a couple notes about 1995, and I actually wrote about the IPO of Netscape, which you're way too young, but that's where Andreessen came from. And my first days on Wall Street were when Netscape came public, and it actually reminded me a lot of ChatGPT. And maybe we'll talk about that in a second. Okay, so now you're in San Francisco.
I'm in the Bay Area. And then again, yes, I am a little younger than you, Enrique, but not that much younger. So I remember 1995, I just got to junior college, 11th grade in India, and Netscape was, everyone knew about Netscape, and Andreessen's, you know, Mark Andreessen's, you know, picture with his head full of hair at that time was all over every technology rag magazine, and we had those in India as well.
I put the cover of Time magazine that actually had Mark Andreessen, and he looks like a 23-year-old schlub or something on it. Well, that was actually in the note earlier this week.
He was in his 20s. Like, the man is a genius, and been very fortunate to get to know him quite well over the years. And he's been a mentor to my wife as well. So anyway, so we came to California.
Awesome.
That's when I told Rick I needed to be here. We had a young kid on the way, and Rick was so kind and said, listen, why don't you just open Falcon Edge's office in California, which I did for a couple of years. And then that's when I met my old boss and partner and mentor, Brad Gerstner, who had just basically started building a firm called Altimeter, smaller firm than Falcon Edge at the time. But my insight with China and India was the idea of investing in private companies and getting insights in the private companies to influence your work on public companies and vice versa is a real source of one personal alpha from a learning perspective and a personal alpha from an investing perspective. Brad had the exact same thesis starting many years ago before me, but he hadn't put it in motion. And I think he wanted a partner to help him scale that idea with him. And so in 2015, after 2 years with Falcon Edge, I joined Brad. And I started covering what I call consumer internet. So think of companies like Facebook and Google and Amazon and Netflix and the covers I've been doing for a while, along with Zillow and then the new payments companies like Square and Visa and, well, not Visa and MasterCard, but Square had gone public at the time. And also doing private investments in companies like Uber and Gusto in the US, as well as figuring out China on my own. So I had a pretty successful run at Altimeter. I joined the firm when they were approximately our size right now, and then was able to help Brad build the business to almost close to $3 billion when I decided to leave the business. So really successful run, and was very lucky to do well by our LPs and invest in companies in China, in India, and the US, and you know, invest in companies like ByteDance, which is the parent company of TikTok, invest in Pinduoduo, which is making waves in the US with this product called Temu, which is really cheap, fast goods from China.
Is it pronounced Temu? I didn't know that. I always say Temu.
It's Temu, but honestly, we still call it Pinduoduo in China. Okay. And then became a China analyst for the most part. An India analyst, because the insight I had in those 5 years, Enrique, is the human condition is the same. Like, we live in America, we have human needs, right? We want our life to be easier. We want to have more digitization of our lives. We want to order food.
Convenience is the word I would use for it.
Convenience. Yeah. We just want our lives to be easier, healthier, more productive. That's the exact same human condition anywhere in the world. And so the key for me was, once you understand the human condition and what humans want, it's actually somewhat simple to map it to a business model, which then is actually like physics. It works everywhere in the world, right? With different unit economics, of course. And then you can just pick which countries and places you want to invest in. So that's the big insight I had in my 5 years at Ultimatum.
Got it. Well, so let's go down this road. And we talked about this before. You know, I have a very broad group of people on this podcast.
Yeah.
I have technical analysts. I have value investors. I have crypto investors. And we only launched a couple months ago. We haven't really had any technology people. And, you know, what I find fascinating, I mean, you're an engineer by trade. You were at Qualcomm during the boom times. Your wife works for Marc Andreessen. Like, you know, you moved to Silicon and you worked with Gerstner and Altimeter. You're as plugged in, you know, obviously there's crazy, crazy plugged in, but like you're really living that. And one of the things that we emphasize to our investors in our investing products, as opposed to our trading products, is we really emphasize selectivity, but then trying to find companies that can go up threefold, fivefold, tenfold. And the reason is if you get one 10 bagger, it makes up for eight companies that go to zero. And now we don't want to have any companies that go to zero ever, but the point is that kind of mega growth, you know, and it's funny, we were talking, do you know Howard Lindzen by any chance?
Yeah, I actually ran his podcast many, many months ago. He's an investor.
Oh, okay.
He's a friend and investor in us.
I'm gonna tell you, Howard got on here and Howard had this crazy story. Apple was the transformative moment for him. And it's funny that you mentioned Apple the way you did. Howard was like, I worked across from an Apple store and I went in when all this stuff came out and I just became fascinated. And his whole technology background is because he worked across in the shopping center from an Apple store.
Howard is fantastic. One of my favorite people.
Yeah, no. We just did the episode a couple of weeks ago. So, but my point is, you know, if you can find one of those waves like Apple and the beneficiaries of Apple, it can be life-changing for your portfolio. So let's spend 10, 20 minutes. We're in this world right now. People are talking about artificial intelligence. That's obviously the thing that people are talking about. But you're kind of, you know, super plugged in in a way that our audience very seldom will get to meet someone like you, you know, because there are not that many people like you. And, you know, we've got like one of my favorite subscribers, you know, owns a bunch of ranches in Nevada and used to run a Meineke chain, but super smart guy. And he loves this kind of shit. As you look out right now, and if you were to say to, you know, real world investors, these are the 1, 2, 3, 4 areas that you should be thinking about conceptually for the potential for 3, 5, 10 baggers across 5 to 10 years, how would you sort of approach that process? So the guy's name is Randy, really nice, really smart guy, owns a bunch of ranches, owns some auto supplies. Imagine we're sitting down with Randy here. Maybe next time I'll get Randy on the podcast.
Let's do that.
And you know, he said, he goes, where should I look? What should I be looking at? What would be your advice to him?
Well, so first of all, right, this idea of, you know, 10 baggers, while it sounds sexy, it's littered with a lot of zeros. So people only cherry pick their successes. And so I think the first thing I would say is I actually don't invest that way at all.
Okay.
So the way I invest is I look for actually 3 to 5 baggers. Like,
okay,
on a reasonable time frame, can I 3x my money?
Our investing strategy, our long-term investing strategy, which is called HX Legacy, which was based on my hedge fund career. I say exactly what you said. I'm looking for 3 to 5 baggers with a minimum 100% return, but no less than a 3-to-1 risk reward. So I cap it, right? You know, as I'm not shooting for the stars, I have a minimum. If I can't double my money, I'm just not going to screw with it. But I'm also like, I don't want to double my money, but have a chance I go to zero. Like, you know, that's the kind of thing. So
let me actually level set this, because you brought in a variety of things, and I feel like we should be very specific on how to invest. So the 10 to 100 baggers we talk about, many of them actually are found in the private market. So that's really out of bounds for many people in the audience. So the question then is, how do you make 10x in the public markets, which happens all the time, by the way, as we know? Well, so the way I invest, though, is I think of it in two buckets. Number one is, I'd like to double my money as well, but kind of in a 3-year period, So that's like roughly 30% IRR. And I want to do it. So for me, what's very important is my hit rate. And, you know, I really focus on hit rate. So hit rate is really important. So once you have a very, very high hit rate that generates doubles reasonably periodically, you end up with Hall of Fame returns, right? Just generally over long periods of time.
What do you consider a high hit rate? What's your target hit rate? You know, I don't want to put you on the spot, but kind of how do you think about that conceptually? Just so, I'll tell you something. Our trading strategies have a 75% hit rate, but that's for small returns. And Steve Cohen talks about like a 55-60 hit rate. Like, so I'm curious, what's a high hit rate for you?
So Steve Cohen is a certified genius. And part of the reason his hit rate is as low as it is in my head is because he covers so many stocks in so many sectors. So to have a 55% hit rate covering as wide a variety of equity products, debt products, just across, it's truly genius. Because we cover 50 to 60 stocks, and because we cover 3 to 4 subsectors, right? Our hit rate is far higher than that. It's closer to 80 to 90%. That's the first thing I focus on.
Wow.
You get your...
Fuck is actually what I'm going to say to that.
I don't see any level of arrogance. I just don't think...
I just
think the focus creates a high hit rate. I don't think I'm particularly more intelligent than anybody else. So focus in two ways. Focus in picking a select number of what we call our generational companies. So picking the game right to start with. And then on top of that, try not to screw up too much. And yes, by the way, we have our fair share of screw-ups, especially in the ZIRP era that we just went through, where we thought a company X would be much bigger, but China changes the rules on you, so that you got screwed, or you knew a CEO really well, and then he got completely messed up, and he completely pulled the rug under you.
Well, the ZIRP era wasn't the problem. The transition away from the ZIRP era was the problem, you know, in handling that.
A significant number of CEOs were way in above their heads with respect to their marketing and their scaling. So let me bring you to actually caution number one in most technology companies. You know, the problem is technology companies, generally speaking, especially in venture capital, they get a lot of media waves and they get a lot of media attention because the reality is you've got to fake it till you make it for the longest time, which means that a lot of the CEOs become extraordinarily good salespeople. So that's number one.
Got it.
And you've got to be really careful on understanding who's real, who's salesy, and really reading human emotion and human behavior. Now, of course, by the time they get to the public markets, during the ZIRP era, some of those traces still remain, which is why we saw just a lot complete SPACs that got blown up. And we see our fair share of what I call carnival barkers selling, you know, atrocious companies to retail. So that those parts of tech really dismay me, and we try to stay away from it. So let's focus on the quality part of tech.
I'm sorry to interrupt you because I know you get on a roll.
Yeah.
That insight is absolutely fascinating to me. You have to fake it till you make it in the beginning is like a defining characteristic of like tech startup.
Yeah.
I mean, almost all the big ideas, that it's not like you start with, okay, we're at 100 million and now we're going to go to 100 billion. You're starting at zero with a lot of these. You
100%.
Have to have a confidence. You have to have an almost like inhuman belief, like, you know, to get through it. And it's hard because I did one of these. It's hard to like dial down from fake it until you make it to like, okay, now execution. So that's an incredible insight, man.
The reality is what I love about the Valley, and frankly, what I love about California generally, despite all our governmental problems, is just the absolute optimism. And some of the people you meet, you're like, I cannot believe this person, man or woman, is so impressively believes in a certain goal and will go to the ends of earth to achieve it. So that's what I love about the Bay Area, generally speaking. Because I've not found any part of America, for the most part, in concentration and density as I've seen in the Bay Area. So it's like, it's this behavior bigotism. So for me, the way I think about 10Xs is, let's talk about the 10X part. I'm going to I always think about process of elimination. So you talk about 10Xs, it's very hard to achieve, generally speaking. The public markets are somewhat efficient for the most part, right? And so either you have to take your time horizon out very, very long.
Okay.
Number one, which is 10 to 15 years, and then you can make those 10Xs. Or number two, you find a company that the world has given up on and they have an absolute rock and roll turnaround, like we saw last year with Carvana.
Okay.
Or number three, you end up at the end of a really difficult recessionary cycle, like we saw in 2009, like we saw in 2001. And if you picked Amazon down 98% from its peak to trough, well, you made 1,000x your money.
I'm going to say two things. Can I say two things about those last two that you just said, though? Because I was there for both of those. Those also, and you have a fair point about 10 packers. I agree with this. Those also involved what I would call a fair amount of leverage. You know, Amazon was actually leveraged. Carvana is leveraged to the fucking moon. And Larry Robbins was a classmate of mine, and Larry absolutely crushed it out of the internet bubble by buying the tower companies. And what he did is he found a great stable business that was a fantastic business right on the verge of this huge boom. They basically went quasi bankrupt, but because they were levered 8-1 at the time, he made 20-30 baggers. So it's an interesting point.
Yeah, it's not our style, generally speaking. So for example, so the way I think about this is, so I always go back to number one, which is either pick something that just extended time horizon, 10 to 15 years. And generally, if you find a reasonably quality company, you will get, actually, I can make a couple of recommendations that I think have high chances of 10xing in, if you look at a long time frame. So that's number one.
Okay. You said you have those. Will you throw them out real quick? What are two companies that you think if long time horizon?
Yeah. So for example, reasonably high confidence that DoorDash will be a 5+ bagger on a long term horizon.
Okay.
Right? Reasonably high confidence. Reasonably high confidence that Uber has the chance, maybe not at these prices, to be a 5-10 bagger on a reasonably long time horizon.
Okay.
Reasonable confidence that Coupang in Korea has a chance to be a 5-10 bagger on a longer time horizon.
Got it.
Reasonable confidence that Nubank in Latin America has a chance to be something similar, but you've got to look really, really long and far. But these are what I call really high quality assets.
So DoorDash, ticker DASH, Uber,
D-A-S-H,
which is ticker Uber,
U-B-E-R.
U-B-R, Coupang, and this is for the audience, who, which is ticker CPNG. Yeah. And I'm just looking at something here, just so you know, Dash has a $55 billion market cap, Coupang has a $38 billion market cap, Uber's a little bit bigger, has 156. And what was the last one? What was the fourth one?
Well, the Uber will not be a 10 bagger, but I'm talking about 10 baggers, right? To be very clear with you, right?
And what was the fourth one?
The last one, Nubank, NU.
NU.
That's a 40 billion plus market cap.
Okay. See, I fucking love this because I like what you're saying. 5-10 baggers across an extended period of time. What's nice about a company that has a $30 or $40 billion market cap is we're past the biotech stage, right? We know the drug works, okay? And then it's just a question of what's the TAM and can it scale? And I can believe, it's funny, is it's probably easier to believe a $40 billion company becoming a $400 billion company than it is a $4 billion coming up $40 billion. I really love this. That's super smart.
So, and there are three reasons for this. The first reason is, you know, if you ignore the TAM is important, but I actually think TAM analysis is completely wrong, Enrique.
Okay.
When it comes to the technology companies, because the TAM so when Uber was created, and let's take Uber as an example. When Uber was created, I don't know, 10 years ago, the TAM, and most people passed on Uber back in the day, and people laughed Travis out of the room for the most part. They said, you're replacing taxis. The taxi TAM is this small.
Yeah.
Who cares? Well, it doesn't matter because if you talk about, hey, how do people commute in their lives? Is there a way to take a lot of their volumes and put it on a system? DoorDash started as restaurant delivery. Oh, yet another restaurant delivery system. But the genius of Tony Hsu is it's a pennies business, a density of network business.
Yep, yep.
Then you know, he started grocery doing really well, international really well. You know, so on and so forth. So I've actually found TAM analysis completely wrong. So may I teach you how I do it instant? So I actually look at the team, the growth mindset, the growth behavior of how the team behaves.
Okay.
And number three, and most important, is the unit economics.
Okay.
Okay. Of how do you make money on a per unit basis? And those three things actually matter to me actually even more than TAM, because 10 years of doing this, I've got TAM analysis almost completely wrong.
Okay.
Almost every time. My hit rate on TAM analysis is probably like 10%. It's just wrong. It's always surprised me to the upside.
Right.
Because I'm not an imaginative person. I can't imagine the future.
Well, it's funny. It said something else there. And I am not that much older than you, but I've been in the markets a lot longer than you. I'm not probably as successful as you, by the way, but like you said something about the network, and it actually reminded me of the cable business, believe it or not, because with cable, you built the cable business. And at the time it was built, we're just thinking TV. And then you're thinking premium TV, and then you're thinking pay-per-view, and then there was the freaking internet, like, you know, and it was just all these layers that kept on, but you had a network, right? And that's what I think of when I think of DoorDash, when I think of Uber, to a certain extent, Coupon, you had this infrastructure, you had this factory that could sit on top of the population and then push out different versions of monetization.
It's a common joke in the business that says that on a long enough time horizon, everybody sells ads. And that's exactly right.
That's funny.
Because that's the funny. Reality is that, you know, Uber started putting ads on it. So you end up with these typically low quality revenue streams or profit streams. And then as you add the network on, you kind of create this in this unfair moat, right? And it's all about getting to scale as soon as possible.
Yep.
Or getting to some scale before the incumbents catch up. Right? It could be any of the above. But I actually think TAM is, so for me, this, I just go back to the point of just bringing it home again. I'm not saying any of these companies could be 10 baggers or 20 baggers, but I do think that if you buy these assets today and you just held it for a long enough compounding window, they're beyond their, not only their biotech phase, but their investor skepticism phase. And they're also now all cash flow positive, so they really cannot be stopped,
yeah.
Which is why then the growth mentality of the team is actually more important than almost anything else. Will they keep finding that next vector of growth, or will they say, I'm good and I'm happy to grow 10% and just, you know, kind of like, you know, just reinvest my dividends, okay, and kind of like cash out?
Okay.
Right? So growth mentality is the most important thing I check for.
Let me pull back, because this is what we do for our audience. I'm going to give a couple things. I'm going to paraphrase what you just said, or parts of it, is, you know, we have this very interesting concept that a $30 or $40 billion company that has reached that point with a very successful business model is actually a better shot for making 3, 5, 10 times your money across time than smaller companies because they have enough scale, enough proving it out. The second thing that I'm taking from you is you're looking at managements that I would call maybe have an expansive mindset, a creative mindset about the TAM actually, but about the monetization of that business. And you want to find ones that aren't just saying, okay, this is my lane, I'm sticking in it, but they kind of have a vision of a larger business on top of it.
It's more than that. See, I would argue that very few entrepreneurs have vision.
Okay.
Who has vision? Mark Zuckerberg has vision. Steve Jobs have vision. The visionary founders are few and far between.
Okay.
For me, the classic case here is actually, I think one of the most important things your entire audience should study is the 20 shareholder letters that Jeff Bezos wrote starting 1999.
Okay, great.
That is probably an MBA for free. That's literally an MBA for free, and we give it to all our friends. I'll send you a bunch of copies. Like, I'll send you a bunch of copies for you. But it's literally, like, if you read Bezos' 20 letters, he first started with one product, selling books.
Yep.
Who would have thought? It's the dumbest product ever. Low margin. But you know what? It could be shipped easily. Everyone needed books. You could get supply very easily.
I have a whole shelf load here. So obviously they're important.
Right. Like, he started with that. Right? And then he went category by category by category by category. And then, you know, remember, he found his way to get unit economics positive because he had the benefit of negative working capital on his first party retail business.
Yep, yep.
And then what did he do? He built this amazing logistics network. Once he got the logistics network, he then started putting other sellers on it, third party, which is now bigger than the first party business. Then he took the same model and took it international. Because guess what? Indians need e-commerce as much as Americans do.
It's coming back to a network again. I think there's something in your model that you're looking at these networks.
As an example, right? And then magically what he realized, everything was breaking because he was growing so fast. His entire software was breaking because they were monolith pieces of software. So he said, listen, this is monolithic and it's creating all these chokeholds and bottlenecks. Let's actually create this thing called microservices. Microservices ended up creating this entire new business model called Amazon Web Services, which is the innovation of the cloud business.
Yep, yep.
So again, Jeff Bezos did not sit, I promise you, in 1998, mapping out what Amazon would be like in 2024. He did not have a fucking clue.
I'm literally taking notes as we're talking here, just so you know. Like, that's what I'm writing down.
But he had growth mindset, one thing after the other.
Got it.
That's what I look for.
Okay.
You know, and I would argue the founders of these four companies, whether it's Coupon, Bomb Kim, and part of the, I just go back to management teams, right? So I also have a specific penchant for companies run by founders.
Okay.
And now Uber is no longer founder run, but the company is such an excellent company. I've got to mention it. DoorDash, I'm going to say Tony Hsu at DoorDash has one of the greatest growth mindsets I've seen in my life. David Belez, who runs Nubank, again, tells you talent is just available all over the world, right? So one of the ways you can look for these 3, 5, 7 baggers is you look outside America, right? David Velez is one of the greatest, I think, entrepreneurs who has this, who embodies growth mindset. Same thing with Bom Kim at Coupang. Now, I only gave 4 examples because those are 4 names I know quite well, but yeah. I bet there are, you know, if we sat and thought about it, there are probably 10 other people I could talk about.
Can I ask you one question just because of the 3 of them, I know this one the least. We don't usually do this on the HX podcast because I keep it a little bit evergreen. But I'm so intrigued that I'm actually going to stop you and ask this question. What is the 2-minute story with Nubank? Because I've heard of it. And, you know, the other thing, valuation means fucking nothing ever, in my opinion. Like, or means things very seldom. It's actually not an expensive stock. It's, you know, it trades at 15 times 26, 19 times 25. What's the quick story? Because that's the audience knows DoorDash and they know Uber. Coupang it's the Korean version of.
It's probably a little too far for the average audience. I would actually not even talk about that. But Nubank is really simple. So it turns out that a lot of Latin America, so Latin America really has 2 really important countries. It's Mexico and Brazil, 2 countries that matter. And Colombia is probably a number 3. And then the others are smaller countries from a population perspective, not from a.
I'm flying to Uruguay tonight, by the way, which is smaller than Ohio. So there you go.
It is, but Uruguay is extremely rich. So you're from Switzerland. So let's be clear about that. So Brazil and Mexico really matter. They're actually underbanked countries. Okay. Well, there are 4 or 5 banks, but the banks are pretty bad banks, just the way all the banks in the UK are bad banks and all the bad banks in Australia are kind of terrible banks. The consumer has been screwed by these banks for many, many years. Brazil, you have 1 very good bank and 3 kind of pretty bad banks. That's the industry structure there.
Okay.
Many bad Brazilians are very underbanked. They're given very poor service. They are not given access to credit or debit cards. They're not given access to modern payment financial services. So around 12, 13 years ago, David Vela started this business. He's actually a Silicon Valley venture capitalist who worked at Sequoia Capital.
Okay.
Brilliant man who knew how American scale and quality is supposed to work. And he took that and embedded that within one of the greatest financial markets in the world. As you know, going back many, many years, financials in Brazil is a very productive and very profitable area to invest in, which is why one of the greatest banks in the world, you probably haven't heard of, is called Banco Itaú in Brazil.
I speak fluent Portuguese. Is that right? I've spent over probably 9 months in Brazil. So I actually am familiar with Itaú.
Fantastic. But. So you know Banco Itaú. So my point is, so he started with a simple credit card that everyone could use, then a little debit card that he could use, then went into things like, you know, peer-to-peer payments. And before you knew it, everybody wanted that card, the little beautiful purple card, and put it down. Right, when they went to a restaurant and then pay their friends through it through their excellent, beautiful app. And then now is an entire suite of products that Brazilian customers use. And now I think half of the Brazilian population actually touches 1 Nubank product.
Interesting.
And by the way, you would think, oh, are you completely penetrated? Maybe from a consumer perspective, but that's the beauty of layering on products.
Right.
The growth mentality I talked about. So they have an insurance product. I think less than 1%. They have less than 5% of Brazilian insurance market share. You take about market share by product, it is sub 10%. What does it tell you? They've gotten all the consumers, or the consumers will keep growing, and then they can start monetizing because people will use more and more of their share of wallet on the Nubank ecosystem. Now, hold on. Once they took that entire product suite, they literally took that and slapped it into Colombia and Mexico.
Yeah.
So the cohort, the way they're growing in Mexico, the way they're growing in Colombia, is a rocket ship. Because guess what? The Mexicans and the Colombians have the same human needs that Brazilians do. I would argue we need those same things in America, right? And so eventually, if Square and Chime don't get their act together, Nubank will do it for them.
Right?
And we have a similar company called Monzo in the UK. So let me give you an example of how we invest, right? It's about 1 insight, Enrique. So I had the insight about this years ago. I could not find a company in America. I could not find a company in China. But I found a company in Latin America called Nubank.
Okay.
I took the same insight and then I used the same framework to invest in a company called Monzo in the UK.
Yep.
Because I looked at the industry structure. three or four banks, horrible customer service, screwing the customers whenever they can. Customers want new services, rich and increasing richer countries, and a what I call a supportive regulatory system. And so we invested in Monzo in the UK, which is now doing north of $1 billion net revenue.
Is that public or private?
Monzo. It'll go public in a couple of years.
Okay, we do public and private.
So that's the way we invest often. We take an insight, and then we see what else can we do around the world? Because the human condition is the same.
No, I love this. And what I remember, I actually originally started in private equity at Lehman back in like 96 when, I mean, I took things public that like, you know, we took Qualcomm public a couple of years before, like, but we were looking at a lot of things and a lot of them didn't work out, but it's kind of the same premise. It was the eBay of Europe, the this of that, but it kind of got to your thesis here is that if there's a fundamental model that would work in the U.S. to serve those needs, it would work in Germany, it would work in India, it would work in...
Yeah, but the problem, Enrique, is that it's a very easy thing to sell, right? Oh, the X of Y, the Y of Z. It comes back to that talk is cheap. The hard part is finding that special entrepreneur, that special management team, that growth mentality, right? To be able to, you know, kind of like break through walls to achieve that goal, right? Because you and me have ideas all the time. I have friends who said, oh, I had the idea for Uber before Travis did. I'm like, well, no shit, genius. Why don't you do it then? Travis did it. Travis fought against every single regulatory framework in America to make Uber what it is.
So let's go back. I'm sorry I like to categorize, but I think it's good for our audience. Because I think there's some really interesting insights here. First is, again, and I'm sorry to be repetitive, you're looking for businesses that have essentially somewhat de-risked and proven scale. We're using market cap as a
proxy. In the public markets. And generally between, in consumer internet, generally more than 25 billion is a sweet spot.
Okay.
Now, I don't screen for it, but I kind of know it when I see it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And in software, it's generally more than, you know, let's say, you know, $10 billion in enterprise value.
Okay.
And so people say, hey, why don't you, what alpha is there to be made? I'm like, there's plenty of alpha to be made. In fact, that's the most de-risked part of the ecosystem. That's the tri-tip, or whatever, use a beef term. That's the Wagyu beef.
What I said before is I kind of spoke about this. You want to avoid wipeouts. Like, look, if you can harvest venture type returns without the fucking zeros, that in and of itself, just avoiding zeros. So a certain amount of scale. I think that everything that you're looking at also has sort of a network kind of impact, which then goes into this third thing, which is this growth mindset, as you call it, which is an ability to put that on top of the network. But then the fourth one, it's interesting because you call it management. I also call it execution. So when we look at, but I'm very quantitative about it. When I look at a name, many of my names, or all my trading names, by the way, but even then my investing names, so surprisingly enough, I'm a little bit more open-minded. I actually look at earnings revisions and I look at growth. I look at earnings revisions and I look at their ability to beat numbers. And while I may be willing to buy something that has negative revisions and is missing numbers, I much prefer to look at a company and say, this is the opportunity, they're growing like this, and they're beating numbers, and then I kind of don't care what valuation I'm paying, but those beating numbers and positive revisions is the physical proof to me of execution. Because we talk about execution all we want, but show it in the fucking numbers. So
No, 100%. So let me give you so first of all, you know, what you described is the physics of gravity, right? Like companies, stocks go up when companies beat numbers. So obviously, yes. I'm talking
that's,
about
that's
stuff
our rule day. Number one, beat qualitative, numbers.
Of course, beat numbers and beat numbers for the quarter, for the year, for 3 years ahead, and have varying perception on earnings and revenues, right? Yep. That's literally, I can say this in my sleep, right? So
can I stop you? I'm sorry. I know I keep interrupting you. I want to write that down. Okay. So you said beat numbers for the quarter, the year, the 3 year.
And 3 years out.
And what was the last part?
I have variant perception on revenues and earnings. Okay. Some definition of earnings.
Variant perception on revenues. Okay. I'm going to get the fucking tattoo of that dude. I'm kidding, but I couldn't.
This is the holy grail of investing in the way Tiger Fund or our investment.
And there's so much bullshit and noise amongst investors about this quarter, this interest rate, this. But what you said, and we are so aligned here, is grow, beat numbers, show consistency, and let me have a variant perception of that growth. So 1 to 5, but you're actually going to do 1 to 10. And if you nail one of those, you're going to crush it. You know, is my opinion. This is great. I love
it. See, that's the what I call the ultimate, the heartbeat, right? The physics of gravity. If you can't do that on a 1 to 3 year basis, stocks don't generally work unless you get lucky that multiples expand. I'm not going to assume that I'm a lucky person, right? I'm just going to, hey, I'm going to buy assets that will be bigger in a few years. And as long as I buy them at a reasonable price and I don't do things completely stupid, I'm actually in a good place. And I don't even, by the way, I do not fantasize about the 5 to 10Xs at all, by the way.
Yep.
I do not, as a firm, right? I care about a very different framework. Now, you made another point on you don't like to go against earnings revisions. So when a company is beating earnings and beating revenues on a 1 to 3 year basis, you actually have the confidence. You said something again, I don't care about valuation. Now, I do care about valuation quite a bit, but at least you have the confidence that, you know, that there is some chance that even if you get the valuation wrong, you'll get the numbers right, so you won't lose money on a commingled basis.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I'm not saying I don't care about valuation. What I'm saying is that, like, valuation's what is my final check, not my initial
always
check, okay? A lot of investors, it's human fucking nature, or it's the cult of Buffett. And by the way, and I've gone down this road a bunch, a huge Buffett and Munger fan, they didn't make any of their money because they bought cheap shit. They bought things at a reasonable price, and then they grew like crazy.
Quality, exactly. It's about quality.
Coca-Cola was a great stock, not because they bought it cheap, because it wasn't even that cheap when they bought it. It was a great stock because it went up they grew earnings a gajillion percent. Apple was not a cheap stock when they bought it. It went up because they grew earnings 300-fold or whatever the hell it is. So I guess my point was, it's just like the easy thing to do psychologically, and what the cult that's out there that dominates investing, especially in retail, is buy it at the right price. But I'm like, if you buy a piece of garbage at the right price, it still stinks. Versus if I can find a reasonable price for a great business, you know, and now Buffett and Munger, and this is the trick for investors. Buffett and Munger will say, well, let's buy a great business at a great price. Yes. Obviously, but like we all want that. You're not going to win the lottery. Like that happens once, twice, three times in a lifetime. So, okay.
No, I would say this generally again, that listen, this is where even again, when I was a retail investor, remember I got my first start watching CNBC 15 years ago as a dumb retail investor. And I was truly dumb because I was watching Jim Cramer. Years later,
you've never been dumb. You've been inexperienced. How about that? With you in particular,
No, I had no experience. I had no mentors. I didn't know what to do, right? So what do? You pick up, you watch CNBC all day and you think you day trade stocks for a living. And I've just learned. So, fun side note, like I've banned CNBC in the office for years. Like we are not allowed to watch CNBC, no subscriptions. In fact, no TVs allowed in the office. You come to the office, there'll be no TVs. Like you can do a lot of the work you're doing simply by reading 10 Ks and Qs. Very boring. And I'm extremely boring.
Right, right.
I'm very proud to be boring. My point again is back to quality. Beats numbers. The only time I will tell you that, again, this comes from experience, so I wouldn't recommend it to most people. So sometimes you know what the inevitable state of a company is.
Okay.
When you do something long enough, that's when what you do is you can actually have the confidence and frankly the balls to get ahead of the stock and catch a falling knife often.
Yeah.
And in the face of negative revision, that's very unpleasant. And so you got to just do things like sizing it small and making sure you don't use a shirt.
I didn't say I won't do it. Yeah, the funny thing is, in my trading, I never fucking do it because in my trading, I'm looking at a broad swath of companies and I'm willing to buy a good company, you know, and I really don't focus on valuation and trading. In my investing, I'll add two things, one of which I don't think you do. I do a lot of asset investing where I'll buy something I'm buying a dollar at 32 cents, you know, book value kind of garbage. I'm doing a lot of like, I know this asset. I don't know if you remember this, but they used to call me the Game of Thrones master at the fund because I had so much M&A because I just had an ability to do that. But I actually wish in my career, and I've been very successful at that, I did more of what you're doing, or this focus on growth. That's my single best piece of advice to a young person is do not focus on value. Actually, do not focus on value. Focus primarily on growth. Focus on making money, though, is actually the way I would say it.
We've all evolved in different ways, Enrique. So I'll tell you what my philosophy is, and I have high conviction in this philosophy. I'm not saying it's right for everybody. I focus on quality.
Okay.
Like, I just care about quality. That's the way we build a firm. Like, I built this firm 4 years ago, and I did my offsite just 2.5 weeks ago, and I just reiterated to everybody that we're here for quality and excellence. That's really what drives the firm. That drives our quality of analyst teams, quality of research, quality of LPs, quality of the way we treat our partners, quality of companies we invest in. So if you take a quality mindset towards everything, the reality is you cannot do everything. There are very few things you could do. You could probably get frustrated. I'm actually okay with the repetition of doing the same thing over and over again. But quality drives the first thing. And then I tend to be uncomfortable chasing momentum. I'm just not very good at it. So I tend to find a fewer companies, but I'm very comfortable with concentration.
Yep.
I just say, find what you're comfortable with. So I like quality and concentration.
Okay.
And I'm good with not, I have no problem having a 15 or 20% position in one stock. My mental makeup is okay with that, right? Yep. Because I've done so much work on that one thing. And by the way, to be clear, I still get things wrong.
Yeah.
Right? So just find a mental makeup.
Okay.
And then hopefully build your investing process around your... Now, by the way, we talk about trading. There are some exceptional traders.
Yeah.
If that's your mental makeup, practice it, try it. And this is the trial and error story. Find your authentic way.
There's Italian cooking and there's Chinese and there's Indian. They're all tasty. They're all nutritious. Like, you know, they're all great. Well, I tell you what, we're going to... If you had a mic... I would ask you to drop it right now after your quality speech. I think it's a fantastic worldview. Look, we got great stuff here. My intention was to talk about ideas, but it went right into the framework. I think this is a great framework for investors to think about. Let me reiterate, you know, look for a certain amount of scale in a successful company. Look for great execution and demonstrable execution. You do have a bias for network and network type businesses that you then can put a growth mindset on. All of that is the definition of quality. And then for posterity's fucking sake, I'm going to say this, beat numbers for the quarter, the year, and the three-year period and have a variant perception about revenues and EPS. So look, thank you, Rom. This has been great. This actually, like, I don't want to say this because I don't know if all the other people who've done the podcast with me are watching. So this has been the best episode. I think the most valuable episode for investors. There's so much to learn here. People can follow you. You've actually got a reasonably active Twitter. What's your handle on Twitter?
My Twitter handle is _RAM_.
Okay.
But I would say follow me there by all means. But I think the more valuable part is every quarter we put this deck out called A Few Things We Learned. It started 4 years ago when I started the business, mostly because I was flying blind. I started the business with $6 million of external capital on April 1st, 2020. I did not know what in the world was happening. So I told my two young analyst teams, let's read every transcript out there. I never knew what was going on. It was not part of my process. So we read around 200 transcripts. And one of my interns said, let's make this a deck. He made this beautiful deck. I created a storyline around it. Sent it to my LPs, and one of my LPs said, I'm going to shout out to him, called Peter Hebert, who founded a firm called Lux Capital, a very successful venture firm. He said, put it out of the world on Twitter, which is what I did.
Yep.
And then it went viral.
Yep.
So every quarter, as I had myself planned for the quarter ahead, because I think, what did I say? Are my portfolio companies, cross the T's, dot the I's, likely going to beat revenues and earnings for the quarter, for the year, for 3 years,
here
in perception? And that's my check every quarter. And so we just, you know, we read these transcripts as part of our process. And so it doesn't take much to put a deck together, put it out of the world. It's called A Few Things We Learned.com. Or go to octahedroncapital.com and go to the research link and you'll get it every quarter.
Got it. Great. Great. Awesome. Rom, thank you so much. I really appreciate we also had some back and forth with this reflexibility. I just like, I'm going to say to the audience here, I've been doing this for 30 plus years. I've met a lot of brilliant people. I've met a lot of great personalities, great energy. Rom is at the top of that fucking bunch. And like, you all are going to look back on this podcast in 10, 20 years and be like, I heard about that guy way back then. So again, Rom, I appreciate it. And you know, look, we look forward to talking to you more.
Do it.
Awesome.
HX Podcast is a production of Underground Media, produced by Matt Rocker and Enrique Abeja. Please rate, review, and follow the show wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can follow on X and YouTube at HX_research and get more information on our newsletters at daily.hxresearch.net. This podcast is for entertainment and informational purposes only and is not a substitute for specific, individualized financial advice. You understand that you are using any and all information at your own risk. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professional prior to making a final decision.